wanna smash, crash, bash, bash, blast the system. We wanna get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, this pumping rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want, we want, we want, we want. We want a liberated land supporting human conditions.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we welcome back to the show award-winning historian Professor Peter Kuznick, who is co-author with Oliver Stone of Untold History of the United States. There's a new edition of the Untold History of the United States that has just been released. Stay with us as we talk with historian and author Peter Kuznick. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we are delighted to welcome back Professor of History at American University, distinguished lecturer, well-known author with Oliver Stone of the Untold History of the United States. We're talking to Dr. Peter Kuznick. Peter Kuznick is also the director of the award-winning Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. Peter Kuznick, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks, Mickey. Always glad to be on with you.
So, Peter Kuznick, Untold History of the United States. Our listeners, of course, are likely very familiar with your work with Oliver Stone. The book came out in 2012, and it was accompanying the video series, the documentary series. You spent the last several years updating the Untold History of the United States, so it includes more from the Obama years and even the Trump administration up to earlier this year. Is that correct?
That's right. The new updated version of the Untold History of the United States book came out, and it has a book-length chapter on the years from 2012 to 2019. The original book came out in October of 2012, and the documentary series started airing, I think it was November of 2012. And as bad as we thought the world was then, it's much, much worse now. Much more dangerous, much more serious, much more ominous, much more precarious. And so we thought we had to go back in and we had to look at what has gone wrong between late 2012 and early 2019. And a lot has gone wrong that you and I can talk about.
And I want to also tell listeners that you and Oliver Stone have an article in The Nation magazine titled 2 Minutes and Counting, right? That's referring 2 minutes to midnight.
The Doomsday Clock, Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, Doomsday Clock. The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists was the expert nuclear physicist journal that began publishing right after World War II. And they came on this idea that they would have a clock that would show how close we are to nuclear war and potential Armageddon. The closest to midnight or nuclear war, potential annihilation, the doomsday clock has ever been placed by its board of experts was 2 minutes before midnight. And that was in 1953, after the United States and the Soviet Union both tested their hydrogen bombs. We now know that the Soviet bomb wasn't quite fully a hydrogen bomb yet, but it was close enough. And so they moved the hands of the clock to 2 minutes before midnight. It had never been that close before, and it's never been that close since. When we published Untold History the first time in 2012, it was 8 minutes before midnight. That's scary enough, 8 minutes before midnight. As of January 2018, the hands of the doomsday clock are at 2 minutes before midnight. That's now, how much more dangerous the world has become.
This is amazing in terms of how startling it is, and you chronicle this in the Nation article from April 3, online at thenation.com, 2 minutes and counting. You say crises that seemed contained not long ago have now spiraled out of control, and the prospects for resolving them peacefully look depressingly bleak. There's a theme here that obviously connects to the Untold History, and in fact, it even drew some early criticism that you had focused on this Untold History. You were looking at a lot of things that happened in U.S. history that have often been left out of history books or have been left out of public teaching and discussion, certainly left out of a lot of the corporate media. And some had accused you of writing a book that just looks at the dark side of American history, of U.S. history. But in fairness, that's what you and Oliver actually said was the main driver behind the project.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. we said that if people want to learn about the good things the United States have done in the world, the positive achievements, the triumphal record, they can go to any library, any bookstore, turn on any television, go to any movie theater, pick up any high school textbook, and they're going to see nothing but this idea of American exceptionalism. That's really at the core of what we're challenging. We'll get back to that in a second. So what we said is what we're going to do here is tell the dark side, the part of history that is the Americans are not proud of, the history of our wars. I mean, we have a country that began with genocide against Native Americans. The economy was fueled by slavery. We've been a slave country longer than we've been a non-slave country in the United States, if we go back to the colonial foundings. What we focused on in our book was beginning in the 1890s, when the United States decided to resolve the Depression of 1893, the economic crisis, not by raising standards of living so that workers could absorb surplus product that was being produced, our overproduction depression. We started instead to look for overseas expansion, markets, cheap labor, resources overseas. So we really begin our story with 1898 and the Spanish-American War, and then the counter-revolutionary struggle against the Filipinos. That was the first time the United States was overseas, really consistently on the side of the entrenched interests against the popular masses, was the overthrow and defeat of Aguinaldo in the Philippines between 1899 and 1903. It was a very bloody story, which the United States used waterboarding and other forms of torture, basically wiped out all the males in certain islands there, and really put the United States on the course, instead of being this progressive, democratic, revolutionary country that the world could look to as a force for progress, the United States starts to become the world's leading counter-revolutionary nation. Then the United States starts the multiple interventions throughout Central and South America, taking us to World War I and the United States entering World War I on the side of the British and French imperialists. A lot of the history, as you know, we can get into as much of it as we've got time to today. What Oliver and I were focusing on was the dark side of American history, not because we think that everything about America is bleak. There are things that we like a lot about America, but because we want to learn from mistakes. The United States has never reached this potential, and the United States never will unless Americans look seriously at the history and begin to think and reflect upon where the United States has gone wrong as well as where the United States has gone right. And on the world scene now, the United States is much more of a force for militarism. The United States leads the world in arms sales. American special forces operate on about 142 countries around the world. The United States has an empire of 800-plus bases around the world. The United States outspends the next seven biggest countries in terms of defense spending around the world. And we live in a world in which the richest six people have more wealth than the poorest 3.8 billion people. That's the fruit of America's Pax Americana, the American empire, the American century, and it's not one that I want to see continued. That doesn't mean that I'm a fan of Russia or I'm a fan of China. I mean, they've got their own problems, and their models are very flawed also in some different ways. But the world that the United States had created, a world in which, especially with the collapse of the Soviet Union, we became the unipolar power in the world, is no longer the world that exists. And we have to figure out a way to go from unipolarity to multipolarity if our species is really going to have a future.
Peter Kuznick, as a fellow historian, I, again, concur with everything that you just said. In fact, was flipping through so many of the lectures and things that I give in my class that touch on all the things that you just said. So important to have people learn these parts of our history, to incorporate them with all the rest. But the context, it's so important, I think, that you started the book where you did. And when you go back and look at the 1890s, when you started talking about the Depression in 1893, there's major strikes going on around the country. Mm. Labor conditions were really terrible. During the Depression, people were getting laid off, having wages cut. It reminded me of another part of that period. 1890, Rear Admiral Alfred Mahan, who wrote the book The Influence of Sea Power Upon History, basically blueprinted the American Empire and said we need to industrialize the military, we need to have overseas bases, and we need to build a canal. William McKinley and Teddy Roosevelt took that book as a blueprint. In many cases, it almost reminds me 100 years later, the Project for New American Century as a blueprint for continuing this Pax Americana into the 21st century.
And if we take it back to the roots of it, Alfred Thayer Mahan was the great theorist of U.S. naval power, and Teddy Roosevelt was a great practitioner of it. But there was a strong opposition. You were mentioning the kind of resistance that existed in the 1880s and 1890s with the Knights of Labor, then with the IWW, the Socialist Party, the Anti-Imperialist League. There was a strong opposition, and even among the populace. And when William Jennings Bryan ran for president in 1900 against William McKinley, the American people were given a stark choice. It was a time then, again, of renewed economic prosperity. But Bryan made clear that we had to make a choice between being an empire and being a republic. And Bryan opted for being a republic. McKinley opted for being an empire. And we've seen so many of our democratic ideals and traditions eroded as we made our deal with the devil and became an empire and became an oppressive empire overseas. And the American people got fat in the process, both literally and figuratively. And the rest of the world has suffered. The United States has not been a beacon for freedom, a beacon or democracy. That's why before we were talking about American exceptionalism, this notion that's so corrosive, that's so toxic at the core of American identity, that the United States is different from all other countries, in that the United States is better than all other countries. More than 50% of Americans believe that God has given the United States a special mission to play in history. God wants the United States to be the dominant force and set the guidance for the rest of the world. And the United States is different because all other countries are motivated by greed or by territorial gain or geostrategic gain. And the United States only wants to spread freedom and democracy. And Americans believe that. They grow up being taught that. And it's still what's being taught in the schools. And so what we're trying to do, what you're trying to do, what Oliver and I are trying to do, Noam Chomsky, most university historians, is give a different kind of context. Not saying that the United States is all evil or that anybody else is all good or better, but saying that the world could have been much better than it is. The wealth could be much more equitably distributed. There could be much more social justice. There could be some real democracy, real transparency, real press freedom. And that's the kind of world we'd all like to live in, I think. And we're trying to figure out where we went wrong and how we get to where we'd like to be.
Well, Peter Kuznick, again, from early days, right, Monroe Doctrine, Manifest Destiny, you know, the ideas of exceptionalism were writ large in our history and also in our propaganda. And again, you said this is what students learn over and over and over again. We hear it through the corporate media over and over and over again. It's no wonder that the American public has some of these ideas rolling around in their heads. But this book, The Untold History of the United States, it's the antidote to this. It adds a lot back into the picture. And of course, you have so many harrowing tales in the book and also some really strikingly positive stories that talk about resistance and talk about resilience and talk about how close we sometimes were to shifting to the next level and becoming a more progressive country, only to be seen to have more setbacks. And in the early 20th century, the interesting story of how Teddy Roosevelt comes in after the assassination of William McKinley, that was also happening at the time and catapults Roosevelt into this position to continue McKinley and Mahan's ideas, putting the United States more on the course of an empire.
And Roosevelt, who's a fascinating, colorful figure in American history, and not a dope like our current president. He was a very learned man. He wrote lots of books and was a serious student of history. But Roosevelt was part of a 19th century tradition that thought that he was very concerned about the fact we were becoming an industrial society and a bureaucratic society, that the white-collar middle class was becoming the dominant class, and he thought we were losing our frontier traditions. Roosevelt, you know, grew up as a wimp, as a sickly kid, got the crap beat out of him. Then he decided he was going to remake his body and then became this tough macho guy who went out west and learned how to shoot and how to ride. and get into bar fights and beat people up. Then when it came time, he was Assistant Secretary of the Navy, and the U.S. entered the Spanish-American War. Then he got his brigade together, the Rough Riders, and he single-handedly won, you know, he's like the Rambo of the Spanish-American War, according to his own memoirs. But he rode that into the White House, this idea of being a war hero. But he wanted America to be tough, and he wanted to expand, and he was a naked imperialist. He was not overall, in every way, a terrible person. When he runs again for the presidency in 1912, by that time, when he's running in that remarkable race against Eugene Debs, against Woodrow Wilson and Taft, Roosevelt, by that time, is almost sounding like a socialist in terms of a lot of his views. When the U.S. gets involved in World War I, he's back to being the old flag-waving warmonger again, and he asks Wilson to let him raise a division of volunteers and go there and fight. He's 50 years old already. But even Roosevelt learned a lesson in World War I. Because warfare had been changing. It wasn't the kind of romantic vision of war that he had. And four of his sons volunteered for combat in World War I. Two of them were wounded, and his youngest son, Quentin, was killed. It was shot out of the air. And Roosevelt never recovered. He was a broken man after that. He died 6 months later. So even Roosevelt could not deal with the realities of modern warfare, becoming increasingly technological, increasingly impersonal, increasingly unheroic. How heroic is it to sit in an office 8,000 miles away and work on a computer and operate a drone killing anonymous people on the other side of the world? Modern warfare is not the fantasy that these guys had in the late 19th century.
I'd like to remind listeners, we're speaking with historian Peter Kuznick. He is co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States, now out in an updated edition. So after this brief musical break, we're going to return with historian Peter Kuznick. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we are joined by Professor of History at American University, Peter Kuznick. He is co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. Came out in 2012 with a companion pen-part documentary series that, of course, you can now see online. And also, there's a new updated and expanded edition. Yes, expanded from the 700-plus pages that it was. There is now a new near book length chapter from 2012 to 2019 that's out now, The Untold History of the United States.
The new one is actually more than 900 pages now.
So that's certainly the book length, couple hundred pages that you've added. And I'm sure that there were still things that you couldn't get in. And the clock keeps ticking. We were talking about the doomsday clock earlier. But as Andy Roth at Project Censored and I say, when we write these books, the censored books every year, as we're writing them, so much is happening. We can't keep up. But eventually book has to go to publish. And
exactly.
I know that you had that challenge because so many things have happened even since January that we could be adding and talking about. But before we get into the very present, you know, I was having a good time talking with you about this early 20th century history because I think that there are some significant lessons that we end up not learning because of what we talked about earlier of how a lot of this history is just down the memory hole. It's not widely taught or it's not widely expressed in the public. So even if you might get it at the university level, by the time you get to an upper division course, it doesn't come through the media. It doesn't come through the high schools or public education in that regard. And so that leads me to this, too, is that you also have another version of the young people's untold history. And you now have another edition of that out. Could you remind listeners about that?
We're going to have four volumes in total. The second volume just came out in January. The first volume goes up through 1945. The second volume goes up to 1962 through the Cuban Missile Crisis. This one was adapted by a terrific young historian named Eric Singer, who was a PhD student of mine. Adapting a book like Untold History into a young reader's book for middle school students, high school students, is really a very, very different kind of skill set. Eric was a high school teacher. He was a curriculum designer. He's been training teachers for years and has an incredible knack for doing this. So I was amazed at how good this is, how different in some ways it is from the book that Oliver and I wrote, and how exciting this is going to be. We've gotten a half dozen reviews so far. Every single one is absolutely glowing. I got one just yesterday that said this has to be on the top of everybody's list, that this is a must read for anybody between the ages of sixth grade and high school. So we're trying to reach people on every level. We've got the documentary film series. We've got the big book. We've got a book called The Concise Untold History of the United States, which is smaller. It's not an abridged version. It's based on the documentary film scripts. It's a different version. And then we have a graphic novel that we're working on that will be out before too long also. The key is to try to reach people. The book is out in almost 20 languages. We just got word of another translation in India. It's going to come out in Marathi, which is the third main language in India behind Hindi and Bengali. And I've been to India in January 2018 and January 2019 on speaking tours in India. And the areas that I was in, I probably spoke at a dozen different colleges and universities where Marathi is the local language. This is the 19th most widely used language on the planet now. And we're just trying to reach people every way we can. Americans know almost no history. And if you don't understand the past, you're not just going to repeat it, you're going to worsen it. And the world, so the point that we were making in the beginning of the show, you and I, was that things have gotten worse since 2012, that the world is much more dangerous. For example, Secretary of Defense Mattis, in January 2018, puts out the new national security strategy, and it says that international terrorism is no longer the main security threat to the United States. The main security threat now is Russia and China. And we look at America's policy, we're facing these really dangerous confrontations with both Russia and China that have both gotten even worse under Donald Trump. Trump might have said he wanted to be friends with Russia, but he certainly hasn't acted in any way that would carry that out. I was in Russia in the last few years, and I was constantly debating all of my Russian colleagues. I asked a top official in the Russian Duma, why the F did you and all of your colleagues support Trump in 2016? And he said to me, Peter, for one reason only. He said he wanted to be friends with Russia. I warned them never to believe a word of that when I was there. I said, as much as I am critical of Hillary Clinton, there is going to be no comparison between a Clinton presidency, somebody who's a hawk, a warmonger, yes, but is, for the most part, a rational and predictable human being, and a Trump presidency, a narcissistic, shallow, megalomaniac whose militaristic bullying instincts are going to pose a dangerous threat. When we just get to the nuclear issue, for example, Trump said during the campaign, he said, what's the point of having nuclear weapons if we can't use them? He's right. There's no point. Get rid of them. That's right. Not his conclusion. His conclusion is we have to make them more usable. And if you look at Trump's February 2018 nuclear posture review, he's talking about increased use and purpose for nuclear weapons. He's talking about creating two new kinds of nuclear weapons, creating smaller nuclear weapons that'll be much more usable. We can't just blame Trump for that, because it was Barack Obama. Barack Obama won the Nobel Peace Prize based upon his 2009 Prague speech, in which he called for abolition of nuclear weapons. But what was the reality of this under Obama? Obama actually cut nuclear weapons less than any of his predecessors going back for decades. Obama actually instituted a 30-year, trillion-dollar modernization of every aspect of the nuclear arsenal, the purpose of which was to make them more usable, okay, more reliable, more efficient, but also more usable. And now the estimate is that it's going to cost not $1 trillion, like Obama said, but $1.7 trillion. And this is reckless. This is dangerous. Obama should give back that Nobel Prize. At least Lay Duck Tho, in 1973, had the decency to refuse the Nobel Peace Prize when he and Kissinger were awarded it, and he knew that the war was still going on in Vietnam. Kissinger, of course, was happy to get it. Trump actually gave himself the Nobel Peace Prize. He actually got Abe to nominate him because of the great things he was doing with Korea. Abe, the Japanese prime minister, a close ally of Trump's.
And you actually get into some of that in your Nation article. The Nation article is a good teaser for people to see the angle that you and Oliver Stone have here. And you do go into the Obama years. You do talk about NATO's unabated expansion to Russia's doorstep, as you put it. You talk about the Asia pivot. In other words, now we're getting into some of the post-2012 material. So, Peter Kuznick, talk to us a little bit about this updated version of Untold History and maybe a little about the process and about how you chose what to cover.
The challenge with this one is that Trump is so mercurial, such a pyromaniac in a sense, that we had to update it every day. I never wanted to let go of this. I never wanted to give it to the publisher. I never wanted to say it was finished because something crazy was happening every single day. There's never been a president like Trump. There's never been a president who's more mendacious than Trump. In his first 700 days in office, he was documented to have told over 7,500 lies. The man lies like most people speak. He opens his mouth and he's lying. He doesn't care. I guess we're in the post-truth era in some people's thinking, but that's very, very dangerous. He's not the first president to lie. You look at, of course, the notion of the credibility gap started under Lyndon Johnson because of his lies on Vietnam. Nixon was a pathological liar. Reagan was non compos mentis. He didn't know whether he was lying or telling the truth. He would make up quotes. Speaks, his press secretary, would make up quotes for him. He admitted it. He would later make up quotes for Reagan. We can attribute some of it to his dementia. But not really, because this stuff began much, much earlier in his life. And George W. Bush, big lies. Obama was not so much of a liar the way the others were. In a sense, we give Obama a little bit of credit. What we say is that Obama restored a kind of dignity to the presidency that had been, I'd say, missing since John Kennedy. But when I look at Obama's policies, I find them very, very disappointing. Obama, who should have known better and should have understood better, actually becomes just a more effective salesman for the American empire. Ari Fleischer, Bush's press secretary, said that when Obama got reelected, Fleischer says, this is really George Bush's fourth term. And other members of the Bush administration seconded that view. Obama had legitimized things that Bush and Cheney were doing that American people were horrified at, were revolting against. But Obama sanitized them, made them seem reasonable, and pushed them through. And what was the case? The case was empire. One of the things that people don't know a lot about is what was happening in Syria. It was after the Syrian civil war began, the United States got heavily involved in the very beginning. The New York Times and the Washington Post were talking about, in this early 2013, they were talking about hundreds of Syrians being killed in the incipient civil war. But they were saying this is not an insurgency that's got any legs to it. This is going to die off. There's no popular support for this insurgency. It was at that point that Obama, being pushed by David Petraeus, by Panetta, by Hillary Clinton, began the big CIA program in Jordan and in Turkey. It's called Operation Timber Sycamore. And based upon that, the United States actually fueled, armed, trained, and provoked the insurgency. That, combined with Assad's brutal repression of dissent inside Syria, created a humanitarian crisis where there are maybe 500,000 people dead now. But people don't know about the U.S. role in this. When, at a time when the experts were all saying this is not going to ignite in Syria, that Assad is not a repressive ruler, that people in Syria are not so opposed to Assad, then the United States did what it could to spark it. And if you want to look at it, you and I as historians understand how this works. You mentioned earlier the Project for a New American Century. These were the neocons in the Bush administration who formed in 1997 and then all go into the Bush administration, and they give us Afghanistan and they give us Iraq and then U.S. intervention in much of the Muslim world. But the leading neocon thinkers all had their own hit list of countries that they wanted to overthrow. First, we're going to win in Afghanistan. Then we're going to overthrow the government in Iraq. The next one they almost invariably said was Syria. This was in their crosshairs back in 2001, 2002, 2003. So Syria was not an accident. The neocons had this on their hit list from the very beginning.
They wrote about it in 2000 in a document called Rebuilding America's Defenses. It's another one of those really influential documents. We mentioned Mahan earlier, and it sparks entire doctrines. Back in the early 20th century, we had Roosevelt's corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. Later, after World War II, we had the Truman Doctrine that was then mimicked by subsequent presidents. Now we have the Wolfowitz Doctrine, which turns into the Bush Doctrine. Paul Wolfowitz, one of the neocons from the Project for New American Century. And again, these are the contributors to this Rebuilding America's Defenses document where they name these countries. They say what they're going to do.
They're very open about it. The document 1997 and 2000 traces back to what was called the Defense Planning Guidance. And this was designed by Wolfowitz and his allies back in 1993. But when it leaked out to the press, people were shocked by it, and they had to walk it back. Cheney and Wolfowitz and the others, they said, oh, we don't know anything about that. Of course they were lying. They had written it. They were laying this out from the very beginning. You've got the neocon theorist, Charles Krauthammer, perhaps the smartest of the whole crew, in 1990 said that the United States is now the unipolar nation. This is our unipolar moment. He coins that term in 1990, the unipolar moment. And he says that American unipolarity could last 30 to 40 years, that there's no rival, and that we're not going to let anybody rival emerge to challenge us. In 2002, after the United States invaded Afghanistan, blew that country up after 9/11, then Krauthammer says, I was mistaken. It's not a unipolar moment. It's a unipolar era. It's going to last indefinitely. I underestimated how powerful the United States was back in 1990. Then Afghanistan goes badly. Then Iraq goes badly. And by 2006, Krauthammer is looking back and he says, I was mistaken. America has passed the apogee, and the unipolar moment is coming to an end. So even Krauthammer got that, but the New York Times fell in line. The New York Times headlined the Sunday Magazine section, January 5th, 2003, American Empire, Get Used to It. And they were all very open about it at that point and bragging about it.
Well, Francis Fukuyama actually wrote The End of History in the early 90s, had a similar thesis. And he had to walk back some of this business that he was talking about. Krauthammer at least walked it back, right? I mean, at least these people who are saying these things, there's a couple of them, not many. Because, of course, take a look at Adelman, the guy that said that Iraq was going to be cakewalk. Rumsfeld, we were going to be in and out of there in, you know, a few months. I mean, all these people were wildly wrong or knew better and were lying because it was a reason to spread empire. And one of the most chilling parts of the Rebuilding America's Defenses document is when they say that they're not really going to be able to unleash this unipolar power, Pax Americana, absent or barring a catalyzing catastrophic event, quote, like a new Pearl Harbor. Right. And then a little more than a year after that document was published, 9/11 takes place. And prior to 9/11, they were already planning, talking about how they were going to get it done. So this is a long blueprint. But again, as you see, you mentioned Krauthammer, it looks like some of the people or the brighter folks in that crowd are realizing that there are actual real limitations to American military power and economic power.
It's interesting that the neocons en masse were actually opposed to Trump. They didn't like Trump. Trump isn't a neocon in the traditional sense. Some of them have re-embraced him. But you remember when he was running in the Republican primary, the 50 leading Republican foreign policy experts denounced him and said that he was a danger, he was a menace, and that the Republicans should reject Donald Trump. Since then, some of them have gone back into his administration, but many of them are still critics of Donald Trump's. There's a certain caveman-like nature to Trump's foreign policy that the neocons didn't like, and many of them still don't. So there are different variants on this question of American exceptionalism, American domination, American domination of the world militarily. You've got an Obama version, you've got a neocon version, you've got a Hillary Clinton version, you've got a Donald Trump version, but at the core, they all accept a certain vision of America's role in the world and a very, very uncritical vision. And they don't understand how the rest of the world looks at the United States. I remember that great statement by Samuel Huntington, who didn't have very many great statements, in my opinion. I didn't agree with much, but he said, "The West won the world not by the superiority of its ideas or values or religion, but by the superior application of organized violence. Westerners often forget that fact. Non-Westerners never do."
We're speaking with historian Peter Kuznick. He's a professor of history at American University. We're talking with Peter Kuznick today about the new updated edition of The Untold History of the United States. Yes, that's right. There is a book-length chapter that catches up from 2012 to 2019 in the new edition. After this brief break, we'll come back and we'll continue our conversation with historian Peter Kuznick. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's show, we've been speaking with historian Peter Kuznick, co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. Peter Kuznick rejoins us on today's program to talk about the new updated edition of The Untold History of the United States that has a new book-length chapter updating us from 2012 to 2019, and that is what Peter Kuznick and I were talking about before the last break. So, Peter, let's talk a little bit more about what's in the update, the fact that it's book-length. What are a couple of things that stand out there? What are some of the things that you see in the past 7 years, 8 years that would be more untold histories? In fact, might even blend over to match up with some of our top censored stories.
There are a lot of things that we talk about. One of the things that we place a lot of emphasis on in this edition that we didn't in the original book is the challenge posed by global warming, climate change, and people who are behind that and the crimes associated with that. Another thing that we focus on here is nuclear winter. This is one of the messages that I keep on trying to convey, to get across, how serious this is. Back in the 1980s, when Carl Sagan and the TTAPS study came out and people were alarmed at the prospect of nuclear winter, the idea that if there was a nuclear war, the cities would burn. If the cities burn, they send up so much smoke and soot and debris into the atmosphere that it blocks the sun's rays. When the sun's rays are blocked, then the temperatures on the earth plummet to freezing and agriculture ends. What Sagan was warning about was the possibility of ending all life on the planet with a medium-sized or large-scale nuclear war. Well, the scientists are still working on that. And you look at the latest studies by Robach and Toon and the others, and they show that they underestimated the threat in the 1980s. They underestimated the threshold, that now the estimate is that even a limited nuclear war between India and Pakistan, in which 100 Hiroshima-sized nuclear weapons were used, could create partial nuclear winter and drop temperatures around the globe and lead to up to 2 billion deaths. That's 100 Hiroshima-sized nuclear weapons. We still have approximately 14,000 nuclear weapons between 7 and 80 times as powerful as the Hiroshima bombs. So most people didn't take notice when India and Pakistan almost went to war again. when there was another terrorist killing in Kashmir by a group that had links to Pakistani intelligence. And India was alarmed for good reason, of course, and India responded by bombing inside Pakistan. Fortunately, they hit an empty field, but the Pakistanis retaliated pretty much in kind inside India. And there was a lot of fear that they were going to go to war. The scenario that we always see about India and Pakistan going to war is that the Indian army is twice as large and powerful as the Pakistani army, that in the ground combat, the Indian army would overwhelm the Pakistani army. And the plan is for Pakistan to retaliate with nuclear weapons. Well, so the assumption is, okay, Pakistan drops one nuclear bomb on India, India retaliates with one nuclear bomb on Pakistan, and there are a lot of people killed, and then it stops. But that almost never happens when they game these out. All the attempts at war games for stopping nuclear war, short of total disaster, never work. And so the fear is, and you've got Modi, who's running for re-election in India, who's a Hindu nationalist. People in India were up in arms. There were rallies, demonstrations across India calling for war with Pakistan. The Pakistanis respond in the same way. Fortunately, Khan, Pakistan's new leader, is not a zealot and in some ways seems to me potentially a more reasonable leader and was able to defuse the situation, apologizing and doing whatever he had to do to defuse the situation. But there's no guarantee that these situations get diffused quite so easily. And so we've got leaders, for example, the head of the Pakistani army, in the last time they almost went to war, General Begg said, you can get killed crossing the street, getting hit by a car. You can get killed in a nuclear war. What's the difference? You have to die some way. And with that kind of thinking and that kind of leadership that we have in much of the world now, that's my big concern, that we are in a planet that is hurtling toward disaster, both in terms of the environment and in terms of the increased risk of war and nuclear war. And we have no leader on the international stage who's not acting like a narrow-minded parochial nationalist. It's make America great again, make China great again, make Russia great again. The world is just too dangerous right now. The rise of these right-wing fascistic governments all over the planet, which is another issue and certainly worth discussing in great length and analyzing because it's a global phenomenon. There are very few. Back when Oliver and I did Untold History, there were a lot of very progressive left-wing governments across Latin America, and there was some hope for the people down there. And now we see the situation like in Brazil, what's developing other places too. We've got this string of right-wing governments that are expanding their power and control. It doesn't mean this is forever. It means if we can get past this current crisis, especially if we had some global leadership who could be trusted to take that initiative, I was hoping that Arun Gandhi in India, I'm hoping he's able to defeat Modi in the May elections and potentially represent something of a much more progressive kind of international leadership. He seems to have grown in his years developing to becoming a candidate. And it goes back to an important tradition because Gandhi was a strong voice against nuclear weapons. Nehru was the leader of the Third World Movement against nuclear weapons, the leading critic of international atmospheric testing, the leading proponent of nuclear disarmament globally. He was the one who criticized the United States leaders in the 50s. He said Americans' leaders are lunatics who will blow up the world if they're not stopped. We don't have anybody talking like that, and we don't have anybody providing that kind of leadership now at a time when it's desperately needed. And certainly Donald Trump is not capable of providing that. Even when he does something somewhat reasonable, like he's doing in relation with Korea right now, he does it in such a way as to be so inept, so incompetent, that he sabotages his own efforts, even when they're somewhat along the right lines.
It is pretty alarming, and it is the focus of the article that you and Oliver Stone did that's now out in The Nation magazine, 2 minutes and counting for people that want to read that. But of course, a much, much, much longer, more detailed and sourced history of the last 7 years is the final chapter of your new edition of The Untold History of the United States. given where we are now, there are some sane people out there in the world, Peter Kuznick. So do you, and Oliver, do you see who some of these people or some of these movements are, and do you give them any attention here in the updated version of The Untold History?
There are even some positive developments in the United States. There are a lot of very progressive thinkers, a lot of young Democrats, who on certain issues are right on the mark when they're talking about a Green New Deal and single payer and health care for all and developing infrastructure and investing in education and paying back the sins of slavery and increasing immigration and becoming a more loving and welcoming nation again. Those are good voices. But you know, Mickey, what troubles me is that when it comes to foreign policy, Bernie Sanders has got his head screwed on right, but a lot of the other ones have almost neo-McCarthyite tendencies. There's such a hatred of Russia. And why is that? Well, partly because of Russian interference in the 2016 election. But as you and I know, I mean, that is understandable what Russia did. It's not condonable.
But it's par for the course. We've done it 81 times since World War II.
We've been doing it every country in the world, including Russia's elections. But we do more than that. You mentioned before the NATO expansion. The leaders of the United States, Britain, France, and West Germany promised Gorbachev in 1990. The new documents released from the National Security Archives show explicitly that they gave Gorbachev every reason to think that if he allowed the unification of Germany, NATO would not expand one inch to the east, one thumb's width to the east, they told him. And now NATO has expanded 13 countries to the east. And of course, because of American security, we've got to get North Macedonia into NATO. So it's going to be 14 countries in order to make America more secure. I mean, how would the United States feel if the Russia during the Cold War, if the Soviet Union had expanded to Canada, had expanded to Mexico? I mean, this is insanity. But the tensions between the U.S. and Russia are so great now. Our relations with Russia are the worst that they've been since the height of the Cold War. And we don't respect each other's red lines anymore. In some ways, it's even more dangerous. The confrontation in Syria seems to have abated somewhat, but the confrontation in Eastern Europe and in the Baltics is very, very dangerous. NATO has added another 5,000 troops there. Russia responded by putting nuclear-capable Iskander missiles in Kaliningrad. That's a very dangerous situation. The situation in Ukraine and Crimea is still ready to explode at any minute. We've got these crises around the world, the U.S. and China. Relations are terrible. And China is being very pig-headed in terms of its policy in the South China Sea. And the U.S. is using that as an excuse to mobilize some of the Asian countries against China. And the U.S. is sending warships into the South China Sea on what they call freedom of navigation operations. They've come very, very close to military confrontation with China there. China is not backing down. The Chinese warships confront the U.S. warships, and they recently, they just missed each other by 45 yards. From the standpoint of the sanity of our species, we need to be thinking in different terms. We need new paradigms. We've got to go back to the thinking of Roosevelt and Wallace during World War II. We've got to go back to the thinking of Kennedy and Khrushchev between 1962 and 1963. Not the early Kennedy and not the early Khrushchev, but the two leaders who learned the lesson during the Cuban Missile Crisis that once these kind of conflicts begin, they cannot be controlled. They both understood that we avoided nuclear annihilation in 1962, not by statesmanship, not by wisdom, not by good intentions, but by pure blind luck. That's how close we came. But the leaders now don't learn those lessons. And we are on a planet that's, as we said, hurtling toward disaster. And we're desperate for some kind of leadership right now.
When you talk about the untold history, like we talk about at Project Censored, the news that doesn't make the news, I think that a lot of folks are hungry for knowledge and information. I think people are tired of the noise of social media. And I think that they are hopefully looking for places that they can find accurate information. But the corporate news media isn't covering this stuff at all in some capacity. And then when they do, they often have very distorted or biased views, pro-West.
Let me give you an example of that, Mickey. During the Russiagate probes, you would turn on, or I'd turn on CNN, and I'd find four talking heads, four journalists, four experts, who would all be talking about Russian interference in the U.S. election as an act of war. They would actually use that word. They would call it an act of war. You know, and they talk about the attack on our democracy. It's mind-boggling to me that these intelligent, educated people have no sense of historical context or perspective. Did you ever hear one of them say, well, yes, that was wrong what the Russians did, but, you know, the United States did this to them, and the United States does this to everybody. For example, you want an example of U.S. intervention in another country's election? Look at Israel. What did Trump do? What kind of gift did he give Netanyahu? Netanyahu is in bed with neo-Nazis by saying that the U.S. recognizes the Golan Heights as part of Israel. I mean, the kinds of things that Trump did were so open, so flagrant in terms of an intervention into that election to try to make sure that Netanyahu won, that there's nothing covert about it. There's nothing subtle about it. It's just open. But we're the United States. We can do these things. Well, yeah, we're the United States. But what the United States did from the Russian perspective, you look at what's gone on since Putin took office in 2000. After 9/11, Russia was the first country to reach out to the United States and to offer help. Russia actually helped the United States in Afghanistan when we invaded Afghanistan. In 2006, there was an article in Foreign Affairs magazine, the Council on Foreign Relations magazine, by Lieber and Press, that said the United States has now developed a first-strike capability. If we launched a nuclear attack on Russia and China, they would not be able to respond, that they have no capability to respond to an American nuclear attack. Heads were spinning in the Kremlin. They thought this was official U.S. policy, and they were afraid of a first strike. Then in 2008, George W. Bush says that NATO is going to expand to Ukraine and Georgia. That was the red line. That was too far for even right. Putin at that point. And so when the United States begins to implement that policy, Russia stands up and asserts that this is not going to be tolerable. What the Russians did in Ukraine is very, very understandable. I might not think it's advisable, but it's certainly understandable given the situation they were in. And they look at what the United States did in Libya. But there was no UN authorization No. to overthrow Gaddafi in Libya. And the chaos that that's produced throughout the region, the U.S. intervention in Syria, again, in Russia's backyard, not in America's backyard, the U.S. policy, from the Russian standpoint, the world looks so different. And what we need are statesmen like a Henry Wallace, like a Franklin Roosevelt, like a John Kennedy at the end of his presidency, who can say, look at how the world looks through the eyes of our adversaries. And we don't have people who are capable of that. We don't have leaders who are capable of that today, and that's part of what's so sorely missing.
And Peter Kuznick, I think, again, back to the idea that this wonderful, large tome, The Untold History of the United States, now out in a revised edition with a book-length chapter from 2012 to 2019, the antidote to a lot of this ignorance is education and is trying to get the word out. And I know that's what you do so well and have been doing for so long. I'm honored to do what I do at Project Censored and to also be able to talk with people like you and so many others, especially as fellow historians. I think that we need to see more historians as public intellectuals because not everybody's going to school. Not everybody's going to the university or colleges.
We have shows like your show, which serves a tremendous purpose. But how many of us get on mainstream media?
Not many.
When you see the historians they have on there, they might be better than the run-of-the-mill journalists who they have on there, but they're not historians who are going to offer a critical perspective and challenge American empire. You might have be able to have a certain kind of liberalism where you hate racism, you're offended by Trump's bigotry, and that's good. People need that. But the broader issue right now is that we need a critique of empire. We need a critique of the nuclear arms race. We need a critique of our death instinct when it comes to cannibalizing our planet. Nobody who speaks for the planet. Nobody who's got that kind of planetary perspective.
It took a teenager to call attention to the climate crisis in a serious way and say, we're not waiting for you wealthy people in Davos. We're not waiting for you people. And there was a Dutch historian that had called them out on their insane quest for wealth and power.
And we've got those remarkable kids in Parkland, Florida. Kids are saying that they're not going to wait for our generation to make things right because they can't trust us.
Well, Peter Kuznick, I have a lot of hope in the millennial generation and even younger. I'm privileged to be able to teach a lot of young people, and we work with a lot of students in 20 different campuses across the United States at Project Censored, and we see real promise. There's serious potential, so I think we just have to try to not wreck the planet long enough that maybe some of these people can really help share their gifts and creativity to really shift our paradigm, because I think we're going to really need that in order to come out of this. And I also think, Peter Kuznick, that the work that you do is a great catalyst. And that's why I use your book in my classes. And that's why I try to spread these words to, you know, I try to span generations. I'm very fortunate, you know, in my 40s, late 40s, that, you know, I know people that are in their 60s, 70s, and 80s that have spent their lives doing so much important social justice work. But now I also see so many people in their early 20s. I feel like I'm in this position. I'm trying to introduce those generations to each other.
We need that. One of the things that I do that I'm most proud of is I take students every summer in a study abroad class in Tokyo, Hiroshima, and Nagasaki as part of the Nuclear Studies Institute that I direct at American University. And we take students from all over the world with us. We travel with Japanese students and professors. We travel with atomic bomb survivors. We spend a lot of time with the Hibakusha, the atomic bomb survivors. We learn all about the nuclear history. We all learn all about what happened to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And if any of your listeners or the other young people or old people who you're in touch with are interested in joining us, we have 12 high school students from a high school in Pennsylvania coming with us this time, in addition to the college students, in addition to the retirees and everybody else who joins us. And there's almost no limit to the number of people we can take if people are interested. So they should get in touch with you or get in touch with me so we can tell them about this, because the kids who go on this say that it's a life-changing experience. And they come back and many of them become really strong fighters for nuclear abolition, which is so crucial. There are a lot of ways we can destroy ourselves as a planet and as a species, but the most immediate one, the short-term danger, is still the threat of nuclear war. But we also are running out of time to reverse the climate disaster, so we really have got to have a sense of urgency about this.
Well, I couldn't agree more, Peter Kuznick. And unfortunately, we are out of time on our program today, because that time zipped by. I could talk to you all day about these things. You know, I think it's really important what you're doing. I'm just really, really excited about the new edition of The Untold History, and looking forward to unveiling it in the classroom this fall. So, Peter Kuznick,
thank you, Mickey.
Thank you so much for taking time out to come back to the Project Censored Show.
Anytime.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by myself and Peter Phillips. I'm the executive producer and host, Mickey Huff. Our co-host is Chase Palmieri. Anthony Fest is our senior producer. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. The Project Censored Show airs on around 50 stations across the United States, from Maui to New York. To learn more about our work and find any of our previous archive programs, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and be sure to subscribe to the official Project Censored Show on your cell phone's podcast application. Please feel free to share your feedback about our work. You can contact us through projectcensored.org. Last but not least, thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.